Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I'm actually sitting here in Santa Barbara, California, talking with Tim Miller, who's in, you're in Oakland, California, right? So this is like a California Dreaming Podcast.
West Coast, representing on the Bulwark Podcast today.
And 3 hours ahead of us, Mr. Swift is sitting back in Washington, D.C., producing all of this. So where should we start? Should we start with Pam Bondi's insane performance in front of the Senate? Should we talk about the true awfulness of Mike Pompeo and another example of what Rick Wilson called, you know, everything Trump touches dies? Should we talk about, let's talk about Bolton, okay? Because I want to make up a new word, and you can help me because you're the wordsmith here. I just dabble with this on Twitter, because I was watching the initial reaction to this Bolton bombshell. We have to call it a bombshell. And there was a level of hysteria from the usual precincts, particularly the Federalist folks and folks like Sean Davis. What a terrible hack John Bolton was, that he was the new.
There's
Jim
so many
Comer.
Colorful words that come to mind when I think about Sean Davis. I'm very excited to hear what you've got.
Well, I want the word I came up with, that you could tell this was a big deal by the level of, are you ready for this now? Hacksteria.
Hacksteria
going on in Trump world. I mean, you could see the sweat jumping off these guys about all of this. So let's talk about where we're here. So I'm looking at the Washington Post headline as you and I are speaking here in California. Key GOP senators say that the reports on Bolton book bolster case for witnesses in trial, which seems pretty self-evident that it would in fact strengthen that case. And there's a lot of discussions going on. Mitt Romney is saying that he's inclined to do it, and there's all of these discussions. And then there's the headline here in the newsletter from the Washington Examiner: nothing new. Top GOP senators dismiss Bolton allegation that Trump sought Ukraine quid pro quo. And there, you know, John Barrasso of Wyoming, who's number three, saying nothing new. They're not going to vote on this till Friday. So without pushing for a prediction, let's talk about this. Your reaction to John Bolton, because I got to say, up until Sunday night, I was kind of a John Bolton skeptic. I just didn't think it was going to happen. Didn't think he really wanted it to happen. And I don't know how, you know, who leaked it to the New York Times, but the timing was lit. I mean, if you had to choose the one moment, it's the Sunday night before the final week of the impeachment trial, and this story breaks in the New York Times, and then suddenly Simon & Schuster puts the book up on Amazon.com, and it's like all happening at once, and everybody's issuing statements saying, "Yeah, no, we didn't coordinate that. I had no idea."
Yeah, I'm going to pretty much disagree with everything our friend Sean Davis in the Federalist has said over the last 24 hours, with the exception of, yes, he's got some good book agents, it seems like to me, based on the timing. I think it was a very... very well-timed leak. And look, I think that Bolton also was, like you, I was very skeptical. I remain skeptical. And this, you know, in 2020, hope is not something that I recommend to people if they're watchers of the news. So I try to maintain a healthy skepticism. But I do think, to Bolton's credit, he very much did not want the opportunity or the potential for him to testify to pass. And I think that, you know, the writing was on the wall that McConnell was going to jam this thing through. That's what the signs were from all the statements. I mean, you hear Murkowski and Collins starting to seem squishy. If you can't get Murkowski's votes, the votes weren't going to be there. And so I do think that Bolton, whilst he is trying to walk this tightrope of still wanting to be a credible person in movement conservative circles going forward, and someone who's welcomed in Trumpian circles going forward, while also doing his duty and not seeming to be totally disingenuous when the book comes out. And I think that, you know, given the danger of that opportunity passing very soon, at least that's my speculation, is that's what drove the timing.
Okay, speaking of hacksteria, we have a little one or two different little sound bites here. I love the moving of the goalposts here from Fox host Steve Ducey. The first sound bite is from last fall, right? The first one, and then the second one is yesterday. Let's play them side by side. The, you know, that was then, this is now. Steve Ducey, Fox host.
Because if the president said, you know, I'll give you the money, but you got to investigate Joe Biden, that is really off the rails wrong. Apparently, it says Bolton was told Trump wanted to continue freezing money to Ukraine until they helped with probes of the Bidens. But we heard him say in the transcript he wanted President Zelensky to look into the Bidens and what happened in 2016. So is this a big, big, big story?
Okay, we shouldn't be surprised by any of this, right? I mean, it's like, yes, this would be bad if we found this out. And then when you find it out, it's there's nothing to it. It's no big deal, right? I mean, isn't that really the defense that eventually they're going to get to, which is that we knew all this, and so what? That let's just assume that he did everything he's accused of doing. So what? Let's move on because it's 2020. Right.
Yeah, it's funny just because it's so on the nose, right, Charlie? And this is the thing. I forget who I'm stealing this from somebody, but the there's always like an interesting period on Fox News for about 12 hours after news breaks, where the kind of talking points have you not yet congealed, and where the hacks are trying to decide, you know, which way to go. And I think Ducey, you know, fell victim to this, and I think that he was one of not the only one when this first came out. You know, and Ben Sasse said, you know, we ought not to be rushing to circle the wagons right when the news broke around this. I remember Lindsey Graham, I don't have the direct quote in front of me, but saying that he would be concerned, you know, this would be concerning if Trump actually did this, did the quid pro quo, you know. And then as kind of news trickles out that, well, obviously he did this. This is something that everybody knows at this point. You know, then the messaging has to change, and then all of a sudden it's no big deal here. And you know, our friends at the Republicans for the Rule of Law had a funny Twitter thread I would direct people to about how, you know, even today it's hard for these, you know, folks who don't want to anger the president to sort of walk this tightrope, right? Some of the senators, like you said, Barrasso and Blunt, and some others are out there saying, well, there's nothing new here, nothing to see here. We already knew this was going to happen. But then you have Trump out there saying that this is a total lie. It's not true at all.
And, yeah, that, that
you know, so the, his, yeah.
I thought Andy McCarthy's take was actually pretty good, because he's been anti-impeachment and, you know, trying to, I won't say carry water for Trump, but been defending Trump. And he's basically saying, look, this evidence here just blows up the defense the Trump world was making, that Donald Trump. And he says it was a mistake for him to have denied that there was any quid pro quo. They just should have, you know, stuck to a more defensible position. So when you've lost Andy McCarthy,
of course
you've lost something.
Of course they should have. And you know, I wrote about this a couple weeks ago with the McSally maneuver when she was out there calling Manu a liberal hack. It was so revealing, right? It was because if you're in McSally's shoes, you don't have a leg to stand on, right? You can't defend Trump on the merits. He's not going to let you go out there and say, of course he did it, but it's not impeachable. And so all you can do is attack the media. And, you know, you see it was Senator Kelly Loeffler, the newly appointed senator from Georgia today. I love this as a prime example of the incentives in the Trump party right now. You know, she went out and sent out a tweet saying that, you know, Mitt Romney is a liberal. And he wants the liberals to have control of the debate in the Senate, and they want to hear from people who just want their 15 minutes of fame. And this
wow.
is it. This is
she's been there for 5 minutes, and she's attacking one of her colleagues.
Yeah, what she knows, this is like, you don't get in Trump's good graces by saying, you know, doing the Roy Blunt. You know, Roy Blunt is just trying to hide and keep his head down. He's like, oh, doesn't seem like much new to me. We'll have to see how everything shakes out. But if you're Loeffler, who might have a primary coming up, you know, who sees herself as a potential rising star, you want to get on Trump's good side. And
well,
so you know
exactly that's right.
What to do, which is go out there and say, this is all lies. John Bolton's a deep state conspiracy theorist. And, you know, Mitt Romney's a liberal. And these are where the incentives are, even though the obvious truth that all these people know is that he did it. But they're unable to say it.
Yeah, no, that's what's interesting is this, how quickly they moved to smear John Bolton, which doesn't necessarily seem, you know, completely necessary. I'm trying to call up some of these tweets. I know that our friend David French was tweeting about this, that what they're doing.
Well, you pull up the tweets. Can I just discuss one before we move on? I just have this schadenfreude. You get, you know, the little joys you really have got to hold on to in the news environment right. These days, I find. And my favorite joy of the past 4 days is that all of these senators, Jim Lankford comes out and he's visibly upset. Susan Collins is offended. They're all so offended at the accusation that they are possibly scared of stepping out against President Trump. And you know, then, you know, this charade was obvious from the start, but it's just so delicious that 2 days later, this Bolton thing drops and these guys all have to cancel their press conference this morning. The same people, Graham, Barrasso, Lankford, because they don't know what to say. They don't want to offend the president. They have to cancel their press conference. So 2 days after being performatively offended at the suggestion that they might be scared of the president, they're tucking their tails and running in fear at what the president might think of their comments about John Bolton. It gave me just a nice little bit of warmth in my belly.
That was good. The performative outrage, because, you know, they weren't really, I mean, Lankford, I was visibly upset. Because when he was looking at himself in a mirror, I was visibly upset, and we won't even get into what the president did. Okay, so I found the French tweet. What makes the emerging avalanche of smears against John Bolton even more distasteful is they're not necessary. If you want to defend the president and make his best argument, the abuse isn't severe enough to merit removal, but no, Trump wants smears, Trump gets smears. So you actually have the RNC, you know, emailing these attacks, etc. John Kennedy, Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana, basically comparing Bolton to Lev Parnas. What's interesting to watch will be, and this is going to get a little bit into the weeds, there are folks like Rich Lowry from National Review who's been very, very Trump-friendly, Trump-curious lately. And he's come out saying, look, John Bolton was a pillar of conservatism as of the day before yesterday. And now he's on the same level as some idiot picked up along the way by Rudy Giuliani and saying, look, this guy's telling the truth. And so it will be interesting to see the lines that break down, because under normal circumstances, everybody gets in line when somebody is declared to be a non-person by Donald Trump, right? Everybody decides you're terrible, you're excommunicated, you're done. This one, I think, is going to be different. Okay, so I don't know what this is.
Yeah, I'm just really quick. Yeah. I've been interested in that, too, just because I was so, you know, Lowry, I would say, I would give him a notch higher than Trump curious.
I'm nice.
Yeah. But both him and Hewitt defended Bolton.
Hewitt will get over it.
Yeah, right. So that's all. I just want listeners to just, you know, you don't have any, don't get the excitement that this means that people are going to turn, because at the end of the day, you know, these are a couple of people who have personal relationships with Bolton, who are upset that his integrity is being impugned, and they just have to, you know, lie in the bed that they made by being supporters of Donald Trump, who impugns everybody when it's convenient. But I don't see that translating from Hewitt and Lowry over to the Senate, where these guys relationships with Bolton.
Yeah, let's go back over to the Senate. Let's rewind the tape a little bit. So it's late Sunday, and everybody is basically, the conventional wisdom is settling in that this is going to be an easy win for Donald Trump. This is an easy vote. They're not going to have witnesses. There will be no new evidence. He may not lose any Republicans at all on the impeachment. So even off the record, Republicans were just not willing to say that the president had done anything questionable. I mean, so it was all down the line. Then this Bolton thing drops. Now, you're probably right. Let's not get ahead of ourselves and think that suddenly there's going to be a transformation. But this does change the political dynamic, and it changes that vote for the Republicans. The vote that they thought was relatively benign and maybe easy is really become risky now, because if at the end of the week, with this out there, they vote to say, no, we don't want to hear him, we don't want any more evidence, and more stuff keeps dropping, more tapes. We're not even talking about the Lev Parnas tapes over the weekend, which were really extraordinary, you know, and Bolton's book drops in March. That changes, I think, the dynamic. And this is, in a lot of ways, this is the, maybe it's not the worst case scenario. I mean, the president gets acquitted. He wants to, you know, do, you know, spike the football, claim exoneration. But you know that the Democrats are going to say, you know, question the legitimacy of the entire proceeding by saying, look, it's part of a cover-up. They didn't even look at the record here. And as more stuff comes out, it taints the quote-unquote exoneration. So I guess we move mm-hmm. forward. Maybe nobody changes their mind. You know, everybody's got their own talking point, but you just got a sense from the Senate and even Mitch McConnell, this was a sort of a, oh, crap moment. You know, that they thought they had this thing and it just F's things up.
Yeah, and it makes the political calculation tougher for McConnell because I do not think that he genuinely, you know, wants there to be a fair trial.
No,
that
of course
kind
not.
Of goes without saying. That's so obvious, right? But I think he does genuinely want his vulnerable senators like Cory Gardner, Martha McSally, and Susan Collins to be able to say that it looked like that there was
right.
a fair
and,
trial.
And this right? is a much worse vote for each one of those that you just named.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So speaking of what Trump demands, let's talk about Mike Pompeo. You know, Mike Pompeo going off on this NPR reporter, and I'm not going to even, you know, spend time breaking it down whether or not she picked the right country on the map, because of course she did. She's got a degree from Cambridge. You know, she graduated from Harvard, magna cum laude. She just knows stuff. Plus, Ukraine is easy to pick out on the map. Nobody confuses Ukraine with Bangladesh. It's too dumb. It's not just a lie. It's a dumb lie. And now, I don't know whether you saw this. Bolton is continuing to double down on this, kicking in another NPR reporter off the press pool for a trip. It's just, you know, this is just another example of the way Trumpism corrupts. And, you know, and I've never been a super fan of Mike Pompeo. I know that some people in our tribe really have had a high opinion of him. But, I mean, he looks like he's cracking under the strain. I mean, for a guy who talked about swagger so much, he's got awfully thin skin and he's behaving like a complete idiot. Yeah.
And I thought it was really revealing, actually, that the most interesting part of the lie, like you said, is it was such an obvious lie about Bangladesh. But the most interesting lie to me is how revealing it is about his own insecurities.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That he thought that, like, it might be plausible that she would miss that. Ugh. You know, like, any past Secretary of State, I think, would be very comfortable in the knowledge that the people who cover them and that them and their staffs and the president are all very well aware of kind of the basics of the world map. But I don't think that that's true in this administration. And it's this Trumpian strain of wanting to kind of take the elites down a peg, but doing it in a very ham-handed way that's like not even believable. The elites kind of are patting Mike on the head and be like, nice try. Secretary, you almost got us on this one, but I think that people are more interested on whether you know where Bangladesh is on the map.
It does sound like he lost his temper, though. I mean, it's like you're a big boy and you're going to have contentious conversations. If he would have just let that conversation go with her, where she's pressing him on Ukraine and pressing him on whether he defended Maria Ivanovich, you know, we wouldn't be talking about it. Nobody would be talking about it. But there's they've lost a step because they're so used to being in the friendly confines of Fox News that when they get a tough, smart reporter, they crack. And, you know, when he's yelling at her, you know, dropping F-bombs. I mean, that's a thin-skinned guy. That's a guy who just couldn't handle the heat. And, you know, not a good look if you're the Secretary of State and you're supposed to be, I don't know, diplomatic.
Yeah, it's part. I think there are two. It's absolutely all the things you just said. I think there are two other things at play. One is that, you know, Maggie Haberman's written about this. Some others that who follow the White House closely have talked to about this. Is that these other cabinet secretaries and big officials around Trump start to kind of look at him and wish that they had what he had, you know, wish they had his wealth, wish they had his ability to just kind of say whatever he wants and be a jerk. And, you know, you saw this with John Kennedy, you know, trying to call Nancy Pelosi the dumbest person. You know, you see this a lot, right? Scott Pruitt, this was a prime example. He sort of thought that he could act like a little mini Trump in the EPA, but, you know, the reason why Trump has gotten away with this is because he has a very unique brand of shamelessness, you know, and he has a very strong supporter base that has allowed him to skate past a lot of this stuff. And it doesn't work for these little mini Trumps when they try it.
Okay. Is that good news then? Is it good news that the Trumpian stuff is not transferable? The bad news is they want it to be transferable. The good news is it doesn't work for them.
Yeah, I think it's maybe modest good news, but I don't know that it's transferable, but I do think that there will be other people that will be able to kind of take from Trump and use it in the future. I don't think that it's as if the Trumpian style goes away. Goes away altogether. And you know, the other thing when it comes to Pompeo is that all of these foreign policy officials, Tillerson, Haley, Pompeo, up until recently, have been able to live in this kind of dual world, right, where they travel the globe and kind of pretend that Mike Pence or Zombie Reagan is the president, and they sort of talk about foreign policy in this very traditional Republican way. And, you know, they don't really get pressed too often on the contradictions. And as this Ukraine kind of scandal has continued to bubble, it has burst, you know, these two different bubbles that they're in. And Pompeo finds himself having to, on a day-to-day basis, defend Trump's kind of crazy lies and, you know, erratic behavior and sucking up to, you know, Russia and, you know, conspiracy theorizing. And, you know, I could see how that gets frustrating. And so it's not a defense of Pompeo, but I think that's also part of this, where he, you know, has had to do the circuit now on the non-Fox television shows and take press conferences. And all of a sudden, his little comfy bubble where he gets all the benefits of Trump without having to deal with all the bad parts has been popped.
Okay, so we have confessed there are certain things that have happened that we took a perverse pleasure in watching, right? Okay,
so it's true.
We've done that. I want to shift to a part that makes my head explode, and I take no pleasure in it whatsoever. None. But maybe you could help me with this one. No, you won't actually take any pleasure in this. Pam Bondi was on the floor of the Senate giving the defense. I'm going to admit that I was sort of Twitter watching it, you know, jumping in and out. And I'm not a big fan of hers. I mean, she's the one who accepted, $25,000 from Trump right before she dropped the investigation into Trump University. I mean, she's
big corruption fighter, Pam Bondi.
She's kind of a second rater. The weird thing, and you tell me if I'm right about this, the weird thing is that, first of all, I don't know, I don't know how much she actually understands about Ukraine, but she's standing on the floor peddling the most bizarre, batshit crazy conspiracy theories, the ones you wrote about a few months ago in the Bulwark, where you tried to like get inside the mind of this, you know, complete, you know, batshit crazy idea. She was actually pushing that on the floor of the Senate. Is that yeah. really what happened?
Yeah, and for folks who didn't, I wrote one that's called
true.
Being Donald Trump. No, it is true. And she didn't go all the way down the CrowdStrike rabbit hole or Seth Pitch. So she did stop a little bit short of what you're hearing from Giuliani. So I don't know if that's credit to her or not, but where she was, and you know, I think it's worth re-upping this right now because the Bidens are in the spotlight. But what I wrote was called Truth, Lies, and the Nonsense Trump-Biden False Equivalency. And this is the conspiracy that she really gets into, which is the Biden-centric kind of element of the broader, you know, sort of Giuliani CrowdStrike insanity. And the Biden element is that, you know, kind of he is that the favoritism between Ukraine and the U.S., you know, stems from the Biden relationship with in getting that prosecutor fired. And that is related to the Ukrainian interference in the U.S. elections. And, you know, one example I wanted to bring up that's just prime in this shows just how little she's actually read, and that she's literally just kind of regurgitating these conspiracy points, is she thinks she has this big gotcha on the Senate floor today, and says, you know, what you didn't hear from the House managers was that one of the biggest corrupt people in all of Ukraine was Zlochevsky, who was, you know, Hunter Biden's boss at Burisma, and so it was reasonable for the president to be going after Zlochevsky. But like, here's the thing, Charlie, it was Biden that was going after Zlochevsky. That's something that drives me the most crazy. There was literally a speech to the UN where the Obama ambassador said that what we need is reform in Ukraine. They named one person in particular who is not being investigated by the prosecutor, and it was Zlochevsky. So this whole deal where Biden like fired the prosecutor in order to help Hunter is just completely nonsense. It was the opposite. They fired the prosecutor in order to get in a prosecutor who would actually investigate corruption, including this person that Bondi thinks is like the Trump card, so to speak, on the Senate floor today. But you know, that in Trump world, that doesn't matter,
it'll,
right?
It'll play well on Fox News, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Bam, got him. is Lechevsky nailed. And so it just shows, you know, how little that these guys have to work with. And I guess you have to have a little sympathy for her. She might have had to edit the speech at the last second, considering that, you know, Bolton blew up their entire defense from day one, the night before.
The other painful thing watching this week, and I'm going to confess something that will annoy and irritate many of our listeners, I guess, is that there was a time when I really deeply and fundamentally respected and admired Ken Starr. I mean, I really thought he was a serious guy.
Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry. I'm just.
What year was this?
It was 19. It was in the 1990s. You were in high school. You know, I mean. Yeah. But, you know.
He even seemed a little. I was a young Republican, but he even seemed a little weird to me in high school. I don't know. My spidey sense, I think.
Well, you have a better spidey sense than me, because that was not a great one. So let's not. Let's avert our eyes and move on from all of this. So let's talk about 2020, because you and I were talking before the podcast about a story that you are writing for the Bulwark on what ghosts from campaigns past that you're starting to have flashbacks to other campaigns watching this campaign. You want to tell me, you want to tell us about that?
Well, and I think that these flashbacks are relevant. They aren't just kind of random California Oakland hallucinations based on the local wares here. They're real life flashbacks to the 2012 and 2016 primaries. And I think that looking at the Republican Party in 2012 and 2016 and trying to determine whether you think the Democratic Party right now is a party that is just short of its crack up, with a traditional party statesman kind of holding on to the nomination by the skin of their teeth, or whether this party is one that's done cracked, and whether the populist insurgent will take over. That question is really, to me, all that's left to figure out about the Democratic primary.
So you're getting some Trumpian vibes from the Bernie campaign. Because, and I know you've been out there kind of waving to the Democratic establishment. You smart people are underestimating the possibilities that Bernie could actually win this thing. And it really does feel like, it did feel for a while, like late 2015, where everybody's going, yeah, Trump's not going to win the nomination.
Yeah,
nobody needs to stop him. He's going to fall apart. Just win your lane.
The deja vu is so real. Right? That was like 2 months ago, Charlie, where that was what was happening. And now the deja vu is from like right when I started with the anti-Trump pack, where everybody's like, is it time? You know, should we all consolidate at this point to stop Trump?
It's like, literally, that's the story today, right? That they're getting the money together now. Like, it's January.
Yeah, and there was a good New York Times story out this morning that has a look at something else that I'm very familiar with from 2016, which is all of the anti-Bernies, or in my case, anti-Trumps, jockeying with one another, not being willing to drop out and support one another. Amy Klobuchar was quoted in that Times story by saying, why should I drop out while he's still in, referring to Bloomberg or Pete, I forget. And that's it. And this is, Ted Cruz made an overture to Marco. I think that I sort of disagree with this. I think that Jeb stayed the right amount. He got out right after South Carolina, but some people argue that Jeb should have gotten out earlier. I mean, I think there's a good argument Kasich should have gotten out after Ohio. So would that have made the difference? Maybe, maybe not. But just the deja vu is so so stark. It was my old friend at Crooked Media, Tommy Vitor, sent this tweet the other day, and I was just like, oh my God, this is exactly. I mean, isn't this the same thing? Here's what he wrote. Latest NYT Iowa poll underscores challenge for every candidate not named Bernie. His support has been rock solid and growing. Attacking him is unlikely to peel folks off, but the sizable group that wants a moderate candidate are split. Can't seem paralyzed about strategy. I mean, that's 2016. Check, 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 check. In a nutshell.
That is deja vu. So what's the deja vu you're getting about Biden?
Well, it's back to 2012, and I think that this one Yeah, and it's Mitt Romney. I mean, right? Look, as I wrote in the piece, you know, Mitt basically won the nomination of what we came to find out was a vestigial party, you know, a party that didn't really exist anymore, but that he had just enough strength to hold on. And the way he did it was through, you know, his personal popularity with the party regulars at the time, at least. I think he's lost that in the intervening period, and as well as having the good fortune of having two opponents kind of splitting the more populist and conservative wings as his final opponents with Newt and Santorum, and then to a lesser extent Ron Paul. So Romney was kind of able to sort of divide the right and run up the middle with a plurality, and it ended up that Romney had 50. People kind of remember this as if Romney won on a landslide. That is not true. I mean, people were nervous about both Newt and Santorum deep into that primary inside the Romney camp. He ended up with 52% of the total votes in that primary, 45% among the other three who I mentioned. It's not hard to see something like that with Joe, where he kind of sneaks through. If Warren, this kind of what is required for this is that Warren gets a little boost of energy here from either her newspaper endorsements or from a kind of surprising, you know,
which
maybe
would be the first time that ever happened.
Yeah, sure. Good point. Or maybe this kind of sense in the party that they need to support a women candidates. Maybe there's kind of an idea, you know, sort of this sociological push, what helped Hillary in 2008 in New Hampshire. And maybe then Biden, you know, can kind of track this path where it's Sanders and Warren that are splitting the other two sides. And he's kind of the last nominee from what was the old party. Because I think the one thing that we know for sure is that the party is changing, and that, you know, by 2024, 2028, it will be a populist leftist nominee. The question is, has it already changed, or can Biden hold on by the skin of his teeth? And I think that those are the two paths to consider.
No, I feel that. But were you also saying when you were comparing Joe Biden to Mitt Romney, though, that he was going to be then just sort of a unmotivating, lackluster general election candidate?
Or is the Yeah, no, I didn't get into that because okay. I think TBD, right? I think that is very possible. I think there are also some differences, right? Biden has the black support base, which I think he could motivate in a way that Hillary didn't. And so, I think that there are, you know, anytime you make these sort of parallels, there's some breakdowns, but that's certainly possible.
See, I'm in the very bearish on Bernie camp. This whole notion that you need to go with a, you know, far leftist to excite the Democratic base seems to me to be ludicrous. If running against Donald Trump does not motivate people, I don't know what will. And this whole theory of the Bernie campaign that he's going to, you know, that he will reach out and light a fire under the low propensity voters or the people who had voted for Trump strikes me as just as wishful thinking. But also, David Frum made this point, and I know Richard North Patterson made it in the Bulwark. The one thing that I don't think that the Democrats and the Bernieites have fully taken on board is the fact that he has never really been vetted in a national general election candidate. Yep. He doesn't know what's coming to him. Coming at him. He, you know, he's had picks taken at him by fellow Democrats, but the barrage that is coming from him with all of his baggage, all the things he said, I don't think they're prepared for that. And he's never really experienced that. I mean, this is a guy who only won a general election in Vermont.
Yeah, I have two thoughts on that, Charlie. One is totally agree. The only attacks he's ever taken are from the left, right? And it's like, were those ever really going to land? I mean, is anybody buying that, right? That like Hillary is hitting Bernie from the left? It just never seemed credible. So this is a totally different animal getting hit from the, you know, Trump propaganda machine and from the right in not only incredible ways, which there are abundantly credible ways to attack Bernie, but also in the exaggerated ways that Trump likes to do. And I think that he's very, very vulnerable to that. And I think that tying back to my question about the primary is something that Biden has going on in his favor, which is that in 2016, you know, when Trump took over the party, the establishment had no antibodies left, right? Like there was nothing to fall back on to convince these voters that Trump wasn't the way to go because they felt so let down by the party establishment. And I think that while the Democratic base still has that, also has a sense of being let down. It's not as intense. They still love President Obama. President Obama will be speaking at this convention. Remember, George Bush has not spoken at a convention since he left the presidency. That shows you where the base is on him. And this electability issue with their loathing of Donald Trump and with Biden consistently showing as a winner in all the polls, I think those are, you know, the kind of the antibodies that Biden has that might make the 2012 parallel more accurate. And I think that the more that Democratic voters hear and see for themselves and are reminded of the extreme statements Bernie've made, the more effective that could be from Biden.
Yeah, I mean, David Frum's getting a lot of criticism for his piece, but again, this point that the Trump campaign is not going to hold anything back, and these are not the kinds of things that you're seeing now. It will hit him with everything it's got. It will depict him as a communist in the grip of twisted sexual fantasies, a useless career politician who oversaw a culture of sexual harassment in his 2016 campaign. Through 2019, Donald Trump and his proxies hailed Sanders as a true voice of the people. Thwarted by the evil machinations of the Hillary Clinton machine, they will not pause for a minute before pivoting in 2020 to attack him as a seething stew of toxic masculinity whose vicious online followers martyr the Democratic Party's first female presidential nominee. I mean, you just know this is going to happen. Yeah. Not to mention that, you know, at some point, some of his rather juicy ideological past is going to catch up with him. And, you know,
this is the guy that literally went to the Soviet Union during communism, came back
for his honeymoon,
bragged about how great of a job they were doing with schools and with public transportation, you know, while people were dying of starvation. So, yeah, I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg, Charlie. So
I know Frum, this. Yeah,
Frum, I mean, maybe not. Yeah, I think Frum's getting hit because is he the messenger? But somebody's got to be.
I'm happy that Frum is making the point. Look, if you don't want Trump, because he really doesn't want Trump, don't do this thing. Don't do it. And I know that there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of folks on the woke left who are thinking, well, you never Trumpers. You're not reliable. And look, I don't know what the future of conservatism is, but I'll tell you, it's not going to be socialism. It's not going to be Bernie Sanders. And it doesn't
matter. I got to fight with Matt Stoller about this. So Matt Stoller is this kind of lefty policy guy and Twitter personality. And his argument was basically this, that never Trumpers are basically, you know, endless war, Iraqi, you know, pro-Iraq war crazies, and the Democrats shouldn't welcome them. And my point to Stoller was, okay, look, I mean, you know, guilty as charged on plenty of mistakes by establishment Republicans. But that said, the voters need to be welcome because Nancy Pelosi wouldn't be speaker if it wasn't for voters who voted for Mitt Romney. As I said to him in this, going back and forth, Oklahoma City, Charleston, Phoenix, Houston, like Atlanta, this is where the Democrats picked up seats. Who do you think those voters were? It wasn't a bunch of old, you know, crusty socialists. So, are there other places where Biden where Bernie can offset, sort of some of Trump's gains in working class areas? Probably. Yes. But there is a path that we see worked in 2018. There's it's right there for the taking, and to just shun it seems ill-advised.
Yeah. It doesn't matter ultimately who I vote for, who you vote for, who Tom Nichols votes for, okay, the prominent never Trumpers. The whole point of this is that the voters who gave you the majority in 2018 are the ones who will be turned off. I can't stress this enough.
Yeah, that'd be cheeky, but it kind of does matter who the Northern Virginia never Trumpers vote for, by the way, if Bernie's the nominee, because Virginia was not the blowout that people remember it as for Hillary.
But we're not in
Virginia. She won narrowly. No. You and I are in Virginia, but I mean, you know, people dismiss this, you know, kind of never Trump political class. The Northern Virginia switch to blue is not, you know, ordained from above. right? I mean, that could flip back. And Bernie, you know, it's possible that Bernie could win his Midwestern straight, inside straight with working class white voters, but then lose back some of the suburban voters in a place like Virginia and give Trump back the presidency. That's not a crazy, you know, outlandish potential option. So actually, these, you know, never Trump pundit people, we might not be, determining who the nominees of are either party, but we could be determinative very much so in the general election.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the point I was making is, you know, what you and I do, because, I mean, look, you and I, we're never going to vote for Donald Trump, but that doesn't mean that those voters won't do it, that they won't go in and hold their nose, that they won't say, look, I'm appalled by this. This is the known evil, but I just can't go full, you know, honeymoon in Moscow, Bernie Sanders. And I do think, and I know a lot of Democrats are going to hate hearing this, but Bernie Sanders' candidacy pretty much assures that you're going to have, you know, at least some robust talk about a more centrist center party. What does Mike Bloomberg do? Where does Mike Bloomberg, and I don't say that he's going to run, he's very clear about that, but he pledged to spend all this money for whoever the Democratic nominee is. I can't see him doing it for Bernie, and I can't see Bernie accepting it.
Yeah, I definitely think it shakes up the whole map, certainly both in the Electoral College, but also in just how, you know, these, you know, outside forces play. It's just unpredictable. That's the thing. There's a risk factor there with Bloomberg, with another third party rich guy getting in, doing a Howard Schultz type thing, could be very helpful to Donald Trump, frankly.
Okay, one last thing I wanted to ask you about, because you know this stuff so much better than I did. I was looking at some of the numbers. I think it was the Fox poll, but I don't have it in front of me. This was an analysis, I think, by George Conway, or he tweeted somebody. You know, the Fox poll, you know, showing that 50% people polled favor the president being removed by impeachment, which is rather extraordinary from the Fox poll. But in the approval-disapproval numbers, and we've seen how sort of inelastic they are. However, in this survey, 46% said they were strongly disapproved. It's not just soft disapproval. So I think the disapproval was like 53, 54%, whatever. I can't remember what it was. But 46 was absolutely rock solid. In fact, the strong disapproval was a bigger number than the total approval, the somewhat kind of strong approval for Trump. We keep talking about the hardcore Trump base and how it's immovable. But one of the other stories is how big and how absolutely unmovable the opposition to Trump is. If you start off with 46% of the electorate who absolutely are never going to vote for you, that's an unusual and rather dangerous phenomenon for Trump world.
No doubt. The issue is just the nature of these kind of national polls. And Fox has been a bad poll for Trump generally, which is enjoyable in our Schadenfreude area. Also just these national polls are bad for him. I mean, what I look to are the swing state polls, particularly the ones that focus on those upper Midwest states, and that isn't matching there. So there's no doubt that's true, that Trump has a very strong and unmovable opposing base that kind of caps his national popular vote number. But it's kind of like, does that matter?
Yeah, that's a good point. But also, I hope people really took your point about how we're all, like, including me, you know, really focused on Pennsylvania, Michigan, and in Wisconsin. I mean, I've gotten used to thinking of that as the whole thing. But as you're pointing out, a Bernie nomination, he could still win those and then open up the back door for Trump in, you know, places like Arizona, Virginia, who else, you know, few other states.
And Charlie, if you don't mind, if we're closing down, can I have one point of personal privilege?
Please.
Not an issue for the podcast.
Absolutely.
I wrote something that was off of there was a New Yorker story by Ben Taub about a guy named Omar Amin. And I have to bring it up in this podcast because I called all of my friends at all of the TV networks and said, you have to have this reporter Ben Taub on to talk about this story. It's the most shocking thing I've heard in a long time. And you know, nobody wants to have him on because impeachment is just suffocating everything, right? And I think that there's a there's a concern. Just the two sentence background for the story for your listeners. There's a refugee, Omar Amin, who left Iraq, had a couple family members killed, left with his family to Turkey, and then from Turkey to Utah, where he worked at a Mormon charity, and then from there to Sacramento, where he's an Uber driver, and he lived there for 5 years. And then one day the feds knocked down his door and arrested him and put him in jail and said that he was being accused in Iraq of being an ISIS commander and that we are going to deport him. And all of the evidence that in Paul Taub's amazing New Yorker story pointed to the fact that this guy was not actually a terrorist, that he was a legitimate refugee who is a victim of terror, and that these accusations are insane and they weren't backed up by anything, and there was a lot of counter evidence. And so I think that the concern is that A, there's a lot of other things in the news environment, right? There's outrage fatigue, and B, you know, nobody wants to be the one who's out there defending it. If for whatever reason this New Yorker story is wrong and there was one little hole and he actually is, right? Nobody wants to be the guy that ended up, you know, going out on the limb for the ISIS guy. But and so those are the two reasons I think that it hasn't got any attention. But it's the story is unbelievable. I encourage all your listeners, everybody listening to this, to read in the New Yorker. I kind of wrote a take off of it, but Ben was the one who did all the work, and it's astonishing. And I think the main takeaway from it is that the government was so desperate for this to be true, right? Because the Trump administration and conservative media has been pushing this, that the refugee stream has been infiltrated by terrorists, and that's why you have to shut it down. And so when they got this guy, you know, who is living a normal life as an Uber driver in Sacramento, who is a secret terrorist, it was just too good. It was too juicy. It's too good to be true. It reinforced this lie. And he is not, regardless of the truth, he's not gotten a fair trial. And he is possibly, as soon as this week, going to be deported back to Iraq and to face a certain death. And he's got a wife and young kids here in Sacramento. It's just absolutely atrocious, and I think it's important that people are aware that as grotesque and interesting as impeachment is, there's a lot of other stuff happening in this administration under the surface that deserves attention.
No, I completely agree with you. So Tim, thank you for joining me again on the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it very, very much.
Thanks, Charlie.
Special California Dreaming edition of the podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Thank you for listening today. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.